The following is a presentation of the Cold Slither Podcast Network. The Cold Slither, you'll be joining us
soon. Good evening, Rick. Would you believe it's Dr. Doom?
What's on your evil mind?
Oh, you insulting tongue, and mock my words well.
How about this rumor that you are really Iron Man, Mr. Stark?
And welcome to another exciting episode of the Click Nation's Comic Book Chronicles. I'm your host, Tim D-O-double-G. And I'm joined by the man behind the sound effects, at Agent_70 on Twitter.
What's up, everybody?
We also have at PCN_dirt on Twitter.
Hello, everyone.
And for our 175th episode, we are pleased to have with us the creative team behind the comic book Super! Exclamation mark on the end. We have with us Zachary, Laurie, and Eve.
Hi, how are you?
Welcome!
So, I guess to give a little background, Doug had let me know that the creative team was interested in coming on, and Doug was a big fan of the comic. And, of course, after reading it, I became also, because it is one very entertaining book.
So thank you.
I guess my first question would be, what was the origin of Super? Like, how did it, you know, become what it is now?
Oh, wow, that's a tough question. Well, it started with me, being Zach. I had this idea kicking around since I was like in high school, the beginning of college. So we're over 15 years of just sort of mulling this idea around. But I guess it just started with the idea that I love superhero fiction and just genre fiction in general. But there's so much stuff about it that everybody takes really seriously, and it just seemed like it would be really fun to make something that just, you know, took the piss out of it, basically. And that's where the idea started, and it just kind of snowballed from a hobby to meeting some really talented people that were interested in it, and we all came together and actually made this thing, and it worked, and there you have it.
See, it wasn't so hard.
It was kind of hard.
I guess before I forget, let me go down the, I guess, sort of the credits of let everyone know what each person does on the book. And quickly correct me if I'm have this mistaken here. Zach, you are the creator, penciler, and writer?
Yeah.
And Laurie, who's also here with us, is the, I'm going by the email notes here, so inker, model, mastermind, and editor.
That works.
And Eve is the colorist.
Yeah.
Cool.
And we all kind of do a little bit of everything. Like, we didn't want to be those guys who put our name on 15 credits throughout the book. So, I mean, we all work on every part of it a little bit, but that's the main jobs we do.
Right. So, I guess, how did everyone meet each other? Before we hit record, we had mentioned how, you know, everyone's is spread out across the different parts of the world. So, like, Zach, how did you get together with Eve and Laurie?
Well, the internet is a big part of that. It was originally, you know, when it became very clear that I could not just make this thing by myself, you got to start reaching out to other people who know what they're doing that can take those, you know, positions. And it really was, looked at DeviantArt and saw how good they were and reached out to them, and it just kind of happened. Though in the case of Eve, he was the first choice with basically no competition whatsoever. He crushed every single person with that. We didn't even have to think about it. But we went through like five different people before we found Lurie, who then in turn crushed all of them. So we went with her. But yeah, they just met, you know, just because they were looking for work on DeviantArt, and that's, you know, just came together.
I'm always curious about that that process of, you know, going about and trying to find collaborators, because you always hear the horror stories of people getting together and it not working out, and friendships broken over, I guess working relationships that go sour. So It's cool that you've been able to...
There were definitely hiccups along the way. I mean, like I said, we went through a couple of other personnel before, you know, we found Lori. You know, one of the things that we did is, like, we were looking for an inker, we took basically the hardest page that I had drawn, and it's like, okay, if you can ink this page, you have the job. And all these people talked about how great they were and how much experience they had and how they were just going to kill this, and they totally failed. And she had virtually no experience and didn't talk herself up at all, and she killed it. It just completely annihilated the previous competition. So, you know, once Lori and Eve were in place, there was no reason to ever look for anybody else. So
cool. Hey, Eve, how long have you been doing color work for comics?
I think I've been working for 11 or 12 years now.
Oh, wow.
I have some work I did for friends working on Marvel and DC. I color pages like Wolverine, Green Lantern, and those. But I started like 11 or 12 years ago working with friends. I draw my own stuff, but when I get in a comic group, one of my friends was the best at line art. Then I decided to start coloring. I was I practice a lot of color for my own work. I think I was the most experienced in the color department, and that's how I started.
Cool. And for you, Lori, doing the editing and the inking, I imagine that's something you probably started many years ago also. Is that correct?
Yeah, professionally, I hadn't done a whole lot before Super. I had done a few odd jobs, and I did just a gazillion practice pages. I just really wanted to ink, and I inked a lot in my spare time, and I got hired for a few small indie projects, but nothing big, and then when they contacted me, it kind of snowballed from there.
That's the key to all of these stories. It kind of happened, then it snowballed. That's how all of them end.
What's fun about that is that it's, like you said, it's sort of the unlikely coming together, but then now a couple of years later, you've got 6 issues under your belt, and I'm sure you're working on even more.
Oh, yeah, we're deep into 7 already.
How did go ahead.
I just wanted to ask one thing. I backed the Kickstarter. Was that like 4 years ago, whatever it was?
Wow.
Yeah, 2012, about 3 years ago for the original first issue, yeah.
And, I get a lot of email, press releases, people, hey, we just launched this thing on Kickstarter, come take a look. And so many of them I go to and I look at, and they're trying very hard, but they just don't have the look of a professional comic. And this one thing that just stood out to me originally when I went and saw your original Kickstarter was, this looks like it could be from a big publisher. Like, the fact that you were doing it on your own and you were doing it through Kickstarter amazed me, because when I looked at this book, it looked professional, which is something that you don't always see on Kickstarter. So I'm wondering...
Thank you. And then also, thank you for being a backer as well. We appreciate that.
But how many takes, I guess, how many revisions did you go through when you were setting up that Kickstarter pitch and you were getting everything together? How many times did you, agonize over the logo or over the colors of a costume or over any of that kind of stuff? Because it really looked like it was something that you took a lot of time and care putting together, unlike so many other things that look like they have a few sketches and some concepts, and they're just throwing it up there hoping to get some money.
Well, that's it's weird, because there were some things that we really, really agonized over for just a ridiculous amount of time and retakes, in particular, sections of dialogue in the book and getting stuff like that ready. But there was other stuff that just flowed really naturally, and it just fit in right away, and everybody was like, yeah, okay, that works. You know, it's really random, almost, you know, how one thing that you think will be easy is you just spend weeks of sleepless nights trying to get right, you know, but a thing that you think is going to be really hard, it's like, oh, no, we totally nailed that the first time. All right, moving on. You know, so. But I mean, like, in general, we put as much effort and time into every part of it, you know, the writing, the art, the colors, everything, you know, just even the, like, social media presentation, we make sure to talk about that and all that stuff. Like, very little of it is ever fly by the seat of your pants. We don't like that modus operandi.
Well, because one thing that really stood out to me that I don't know why this, you know, stands out as being so interesting to me, but I have to keep reminding myself that the main character is named Blitz, because I always want to call her Super, because the book is called Super. You know, and it's one of those things that, you know, you always expect the main character, you know, Batman, Superman, Wolverine, like they make it so easy. You know, and this feels, even though she's the character, and she's the main, you know, thrust of the story, obviously, all the other characters feel so fleshed out, you know, Fire Ant, Streak, and all these other characters, they're not just, you know, oh, we took Batman, but, you know, we made him an ant instead of a bat, you know. There's different, obviously different concepts and thoughts and feelings that went into building these characters. They're much more than just these, you know, these mixes of what a DC Marvel character is, but it's just, to me, it feels like we've got kind of a sitcom type thing going here with the humor in it, but it's just Super with an exclamation point just kind of thrown in your face so you know right out what the genre is, but it's not called Blitz, which is what I would expect, you know, reading the book. So there's like another level of thinking that you've put into the book that I don't often see in a lot of these creator-owned books.
But again, thank you. And yeah, that is a deliberate, you know, because we chose to call it Super because while Blitz is definitely the main focal point character and the person that the audience most sees through the eyes of, you know, the book is very much about the whole world. At the very least, the city of Cosmopolis is a character in and of itself, you know, and we wanted to make this feel, you know, like it's a living, breathing world that is existing and doing stuff even when you're not looking at it, which is something we find a lot of parodies fail to do a lot. You know, like, I'm a huge fan of The Tick. I love The Tick to death. But the remember the live action Tick show from a few years ago? Mm-hmm. They always did this thing where it was like the only superheroes in the world are the four you're looking at right now, and they don't ever seem to be doing anything interesting, you know? So it was a very conscious effort to be like, no, you know, there is so much stuff going on at all times that, you know, you think the hero would show up to deal with, you know, some sort of disaster, but it's not just the hero whose name's on the book, it's five other groups of heroes that are also answering the call and stepping on each other's toes and being like, no, this is my side of the street. You know, like, we wanted everything to feel very alive at all times. And hence, that's why it would never just be called Blitz or the Furious Fire Ant or something like that. It's because it's about everybody.
So when you're doing the scripts, how much detail do you put in for the jokes in the background that you're trying to convey to everyone else on the team, or are you just like randomly throwing the stuff back there hoping they catch in on it?
A little of column A, a little of column B. Like, especially lately, we've tried to be much more thorough about the scripts being exactly what ends up on the page, whereas, you know, in the first issue, the script was way looser, and things kind of developed as the pages were being made, and everybody said that that's the Jack and Stan way, and that's the best way, and it is cool, but it is hard, and you will run into problems, so it is always best to plan these things out. We think of a joke that we know for a fact needs to be in the background of something, we'll mark it down, but also many times I'll just be penciling it and I'll be like, oh my god, this is really funny, this needs to go there, and it'll just be there, you know, and then the rest of them will be like, wait, where did that come from?
I like that the Tick comparison to it, because there's definitely, like you said, a superhero parody. I guess that is a good way to sort of describe the book, isn't it?
Yeah, we like to call it a mix between Astro City and the Venture Brothers, you know, because it's like that, half of it is that loving parody of all the genre fiction that led before, you know, but is also not so much of a parody that it forgets to be an action superhero comic as well. I think the Venture Brothers walks that line very well. And Astro City, because if you've ever read Astro City, it's kind of the same deal as us, where it's literally the whole Marvel Universe in one book and everything's just going around all the time. And we sort of combine those two ideas, and this is what we ended up with.
One of the things that I really like is that the humor isn't always the same type of humor. Like, you'll have sight gags. Like, I especially love the page where the guy's sitting on the bus stop and he gets hit by the ice ray, and you just have this panel of him sitting there and then the panel of him, you know, reacting to being frozen, that you have those kind of, you know, physical gags. But then you also have the dialogue that can be witty. But then, you know, you'll have a pun thrown in there, or you'll do something where it's the convention of all the mad scientist guys, and you can just look through the artwork and, you know, pick out these different versions of the scientists from all these different genres, how it's not the same joke repeated over and over again using different types of humor, you know, but it's always funny, but it's a different funny as you're going through it. How much of that just comes to you as you're drawing, that you're adding those jokes in, throwing that stuff in, and just how much of a, you know, comedic life are you living that you're writing this stuff down all the time?
Well, the visual gags, like for example, the science convention you mentioned, that was a lot of like, what can I throw in here on the fly? You know, that, like, I'd be drawing it and I'd be like, no, this guy shouldn't be an actual waiter. He should be the robot from Lost in Space with a bow tie on, you know, and like, it'll work out that way. But in terms of like the more, word-based pun humor, that's more of a, we think about it and write it down beforehand. And I think also a lot of the humor styles being different comes from the different input of the creative people that are making it. I mean, I know you'd never believe it because I'm never shutting up and they haven't said a word, but we really do have a lot of input together when we work. But yeah, and we're, you know, we have wildly different yet completely insane senses of humor, and we all add our own weird little influence to things. And a lot of jokes come from pet peeves that we have about existing comics or movies or stuff like that, where it's like one of us is always really irritated about this trope coming up over and over, and we're like, all right, we're making fun of that. That's totally getting ripped apart.
Yeah, I like the comments about, you know, everyone has a lone wolf t-shirt.
Yeah.
He just shows up all over the place, as certain characters tend to do.
Yeah, you'll especially when it comes to the fire ant, you'll hear a lot of our actual, like, this is how we feel about this comic character or movie, just come right out. That whole thing about the, how can you be alone when you come to a bar full of people? Like, that is our actual thoughts on Wolverine. Like,
Have you sent a copy of issue 3 to Lance Henriksen?
You know, no, we didn't. We totally should, actually. I wonder if he'd appreciate it. He might take it. He seems like a really serious guy. He might be like, did they just steal my face? If I'm ours. Yeah.
Well, it'll be an incredible adventure one way or another. Either you'll make a new fan or you'll have
something. We might get that Samuel L. Jackson thing where he saw it and was like, I'm not mad if you let me play him in the movie.
Right.
Which we totally would do. So.
Now, when it comes to the actually creating the book physically, how do you guys go through the process of creating the artwork and creating the pages? I'm assuming there's a lot of computers involved.
Yeah, well, we each sort of do a whole different individual process for ourselves. Like, I mean, we all work together to do the writing in terms of the script, and once that's put together, I usually do the pencil layouts for the sketches and breakdowns and how everything's going to fit. And I just start working through the pages and pass them on to Lori. And then she starts her whole process, which you should probably explain to me.
Are you drawing like in Manga Studio or are you doing this on paper?
I do it by hand. But pretty much everything after that is digital. Like I hand pencil, but the inking and coloring is all digital.
So you just scan it straight in?
Yeah.
Got it.
And Lori, can you, I guess, fill in, once you get the pencils from Zach, how does your process usually start?
Oh,
by
sure.
Hitting me.
Yeah. First I message Zach about how angry I am, about how many bullets there are on that page. No. I use ArtRage to ink. It's kind of similar to Manga Studio, actually, in terms of feel. It's a lot less, I'm trying to think of the word for it. It feels a lot more natural to draw with than something like Photoshop, I find, anyway. It has the different brushes and tools, but they're, I don't know, more intuitive. Anyway, and I'll ink it digitally, and then either myself or my husband Eric, who's also part of the team, will do the flats, which is basically like a, you know, like a basic color breakdown to make Eve's job easier, so...
Like coloring book style, no
exactly.
Shading. Yeah, just that's why they're flats, I guess. It's just they're flat colors.
Mm.
Yeah, and then I pass it to Eve, and then Eve does his thing. I don't know if he wants to talk about it.
I work in Photoshop. Zach sent me some notes about like important stuff. I never got the script. So Zach sent me notes about some powers, colors, energies, something like that, and then I do all the colors in Photoshop.
Okay. I'm going to highlight this picture that Doug has up just to sort of give a feel for just the color work you do.
Yeah, and again, it's one of those things, you know, when you're back something like a Kickstarter, you can't read the story, obviously, to know whether or not it's any good. So the artwork is the first thing that gets your attention, and if it looks like a professionally done comic, then you're more likely to back it. And that's what, you know, when I looked at this, the colors, the pencils, the inks, I mean, it looked like this was something that could have come out of one of the big two, and it just blew me away, the fact that you guys were doing it on Kickstarter instead of having a deal from, you know, some publisher.
It kind of blows us away, too, sometimes. I mean, the whole Kickstarter thing wasn't even something we originally set out to do. We wanted to kind of just make it on our own, and it became clear that that was just impossible while paying bills and, you know, feeding our families and stuff. So, it you know, the Kickstarter was a necessity rather than, we're going to make a Kickstarter. Now, what did we kickstart with it? Like, the book was well underway before we even came to that decision, just because we had to.
And isn't running a Kickstarter almost like running a second business?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
It is very stressful. Very, very stressful. You spend pretty much all day in 30-second intervals checking the Kickstarter to see if anything's changed. You got to respond to all the million questions, messages and comments and questions, which poor Lori was usually saddled with. And I don't know.
What were the common questions from the backers?
Oh boy!
When is it coming out? When is it coming out? When is it coming out? Pretty much.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of, when's the next book coming out? Like, not even the book for that Kickstarter, but the book after that. And I'm like, what? Like, I could just let us get this one done. We need to give you.
Gotcha. Well, there are some publishers, not to name any names, but they will have a book completely in the can, ready to go, ready to solicit through Diamond, but then they do a Kickstarter in the hopes of getting some extra money, as opposed to being someone who's trying to finish, you know, get the money together to put the final product together. They have the final product. It's ready to go. They're just trying to sell some exclusive covers or, you know, a hardcover collection or something like that, which is a little, I feel like that's a little different way of using the system.
I mean, it's, I can understand on the one hand that it's like a direct market kind of thing, which is definitely one of the appeals of doing the Kickstarter, is that you and your fans are directly connected. There's no Diamond middleman, you know, and you are giving them the product that they have been your fan to get, you know. I understand that part, but I guess also it sounds a little unscrupulous to be like, I have this, it's done, I don't actually need your help, but if you want to give me $100,000, I'll take it. Like in our case, it was definitely, you know, the first issue is 52 pages. We had gotten to about, you know, page 24 or 26 before we're like, okay, we can't do this on our own, we just can't, you know, and had to decide to run the Kickstarter for it. And when we originally conceived the Kickstarter, we were like, oh, well, we'll just get it to print it. We'll make the whole book for free, and we'll just get people to help us out with the printing, which was a gross, like, underestimation of what the actual costs would be. Like, we really, really totally, like, hamstrung ourselves with the, like, oh, this is all we're asking for, and we got it, and we were actually wildly overfunded for that, but we still only got the money for printing and had not considered anything like shipping, you know, especially international shipping. And, you know, we would make $5 on something and spend $30 to send it to someone in, like, Denmark. You know, so we really needed to, you know, as you know, we've done 3 Kickstarters now, and you can see from the first one to the third one we did that just passed that we completely refined the process a lot from learning from our mistakes.
I've heard the shipping horror stories.
Yeah, we had no idea, like, no idea what it would be like, and I mean, I feel like we're still in debt from shipping from the first Kickstarter. Like, I feel like that is still something that is, like, hanging over us, because, I mean, it was, you know, so many of our fans, it was really surprising that it was Europe, Australia, you know, Asia, it's just all over the place. We're like, wow, we did not anticipate all these people all over the world wanting this book, and we had to send it to them. So, you know, $30, $40 a pop to send them a book, it got kind of out of control after a while.
Who thought up the idea for the different rewards?
I guess we all do, but mostly Lori is responsible for the good ideas.
At least the most recent Kickstarter.
Especially the last one, yeah. We all contribute to that, but I feel like she's the smart one when it comes to that. So we defer to her when it comes to, like, this is a business thing that needs to work. Lori, tell us how to do it.
Cool. It's like, Lori, make it happen.
Yeah.
When you're doing something on a Kickstarter, does it seem like once you hit that goal, things kind of level out? Whereas in the early hours, people are like, oh, yeah, let's get this going. Let's throw some money at it. But then once you hit that goal, does it seem to just kind of peter out after that?
Yeah, definitely. There was, I mean, it was hard to tell for this last one because we were actually funded literally within 4 hours of of opening. And we had a really, really strong start, and then there was kind of like a dead middle, and then it picked back up again at the end as it, you know, was nearing close. But we were literally funded the first day within hours, so it's hard to gauge. But I feel like every Kickstarter goes through that, where it's like, it's great the first day, or the first 3 days or whatever, and then it dies, and you start to really panic that it's not going to go over, and then you get a boost again at the end. Hopefully you get a boost at the end anyway.
So what stretch goals didn't you get to that you were really hoping you'd achieve?
I was really hoping to get the Fire Ant toy stretch goal on this last one. I think a lot of people were really excited for that, but we had to make that one a really high price point because toys are really expensive to produce. And, yeah, it was hard to kind of get that across to people. But, yeah, I was hoping we'd hit it. That would have been great.
And that was really like the prototype was so much cooler than we thought it was going to. Like, we designed it and didn't expect something that awesome to come back, and we're like, we need that. That needs to actually happen.
Yeah. So in a future Kickstarter, that's definitely coming back because I want one for myself, but I want everyone else to have one too.
It's just funny that you mentioned that. I guess people, maybe the backers didn't realize that these things are that expensive. You know, it always strikes me as weird seeing, you know, what the prices are in, like, the toy aisle nowadays. You know, like, going into the action figure section, just taking a peek around, I'm like, $22, $23 for a 6-inch figure, you know? So,
to adults now more than kids. That's why it's expensive, so.
Right. So, what scale was the figure on? Was it one of the 4-inch or the 6-inch, the proposed figure?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I was asking you.
I think it was just a little larger than our Blitz toy, which I think is around the 4-inch scale. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems, I remember whatever inch height it actually was when we saw the prototype, we were surprised because the Blitz one, she's standing up, so we expected her to be about as proportionate as she was. The Fire Ant one, he's like kneeling down in like a Spider-Man pose, and we got this brick back, like this solid rock of plastic. And we're like, wow, like you could totally knock a guy out with the Fire Ant toy.
I imagine it has to be a good feeling inside. I guess for one, to be able to hold a physical copy of a book that you made, but also to get your characters in toy form and see them displayed on your desk. That's definitely probably something you'd want to.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's really unreal. It is even more unreal to see people in the costumes of the characters, especially Lori, who makes the costumes for our like actual, you know, personal costume model stuff, not just like the fan-made stuff, but I mean the costume stuff that she makes is unreal, and we have a couple of fans that do it too, and it's just so insane to see, like, that is a living three-dimensional person dressed like this character we created.
Oh, I need to see some pictures of this cosplay.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I actually just remade a Blitz costume end of last year, and I'm really happy with it, so I'll have to send you some photos.
Yeah, there was an ad for it in one of the books, wasn't there?
Yeah, that was the older suit, so I'm more of a fan. I made the new suit super accurate and spent, like, hundreds of hours on it. It was ridiculous, so...
And it is really cool. It is actually the alternate cover of the first trade is her in the suit, if you've ever seen that. A lot of people are like, is that a painting? Like, nope, that is her. I actually had a guy who had the book for literally 4 to 6 months, and I mentioned that it was her in the suit, and he was blown away because he thought it was like an Alex Ross-style painting. And he was like, oh my God!
So once you get the Kickstarter done and you have this book, you have these files, 1, 2, and 3 I got through Diamond. But then I noticed that all the issues were showing up on Comixology. So how much easier is the digital distribution going through Comixology as opposed to the old school getting them in print and getting them distributed through Diamond?
Oh my God, I can't.
I mean, it's not that we had a bad experience with Diamond or anything. It's just, it is so expensive to even try to get into a place where you, just to hope you're noticed in Diamond. Because it's literally, it's like 2,000 pages, and you'll get this tiny little spot in it, and you're like, well, I spent $10,000 once a month to get this in there, and no one's ever going to see it, where you have just as much chance to do it for free on Comixology, and you'll actually get more people willing to try it because, they're like, oh, I can just download it right now for $1, or I can wait for 3 months for it to come to my comic store after I ordered it and hope they ordered enough. And a lot of people just back out right there. They don't even care. It's some indie book. They're not going to bother. But the digital, I think it's more enticing to people, and it's definitely easier for us to do.
It's a lot easier to do sampling through digital instead of like going to your local comic shop and going to the owner and saying, can we please pre-order this for me? That's like so many different steps to go through.
Which we have done. We totally have gone through all that. And you're right. It is definitely, it's much easier. The digital samples are a lifesaver because, people that would never bother to check it out elsewhere will just see it because it's free and they're like, oh, wow, this is really good. Doug, I believe, was saying earlier that he couldn't believe how professional it looked. If you can just get someone to look at it, odds are they're going to buy it. Like, if you can get them to see a page, they'll be like, oh, wow, okay, I will try this. And digital makes that way easier.
Is there, do you already have, like, the ending for Super planned out?
Oh, yeah. The plot, like the main bullet points of the plot were decided actually before even the first page was drawn. That was something I personally was very insistent on because I have been burned so many times by books or TV shows or whatever that come out of the gate running and they're amazing and you're just like, this is so great, I can't wait to see where this goes. And then you realize that the creators never thought that far ahead and they don't know where it's going and they just kind of noodle around until they get canceled.
Like, so you watch Lost also.
Yeah, and it's just I felt the ending was one of the first things you need to know when you're going to tell a story. You need to know where it's going because if you don't, you're wasting everybody's time, kind of. You don't want to wing that at all.
So are you aiming for a particular number of issues, or are you just hoping to go at it for a while until it's time to wrap it up?
We don't have a 100% set number of issues solely because we occasionally are like, no, this needs to be two parts, so we'll stretch it out into two or something like that. But generally, we've always said about 50. We're going for like the Garth Ennis Preacher style,
Nice.
Maxi series, but definitive, ending and constant progression, no noodling. We're very against the padding.
Well, yeah, that's another thing that I've noticed about the book is that the book is very dense, I guess is a good way to put it. That so much happens in each issue, and there's so much dialogue, and all the characters. It never feels like you're writing for the trade, as so many books do nowadays, where something exciting happens in the first issue, and something exciting happens in what would be like number 5 or number 6, whatever would wrap up that trade, and then in the middle, everything kind of rolls. Yeah. And you have an issue where characters just kind of move around to get the position to where they need to be for that finale. But, this always feels like there's always something going on. There's always something that they're being drawn to or something that they're working against, as opposed to just having like, oh, it's the one where they go shopping for new costumes, or something like that.
Well, I'm glad you feel that way because that was deliberate. We had always talked about in the beginning how, it's called decompressed storytelling, I guess, because that's a fancy word for padding, that everyone does what you just described. And, we were always talking about how we missed that feeling of like, when you'd get a comic in like the 80s. Where, sure, sometimes it was part of a larger story arc, but that book had a story that began and end within the pages of the book that you bought,
Right.
You didn't buy a useless piece of a story that now requires you to get 6 to 12 more issues to understand it. you know, like you got an individual issue, like, you know, like the Claremont X-Men, that there was always something kind of going on in the background as the, as a, an overarching plot, but any single issue you got, you didn't feel like you totally got ripped off because something happens in it. You know, we were trying to go for that feel. Though the there is an overarching master plot that is always moving, and like even if it's not in the foreground, it's always there. So we try to walk that tightrope.
Is the master plot dealing with Blitz and her boyfriend and all of that, or is the master plot dealing more with the team and the team dynamics and what appears to be eventually someday it's all going to explode?
Well, it can't really directly answer that question because
oh come on
because but, spoilers
but yes you know that does definitely tie in the relationship between Blitz and her boyfriend and the relationship between the team itself is a very big factor in that, and it will become clear as time goes on.
I tried
good job, nerd.
We're very anti-spoiler around here.
Got to leave them wanting more. That's
exactly. Right. I don't know. Have you ever got that feeling when once you see a spoiler for something, no matter how good it is, you're just like, eh, I don't care anymore. I know. I knew that thing that was supposed to be a big deal, but it's not a big deal anymore because it was spoiled. You know, like I hate that.
Get that feeling a lot nowadays in comics.
Yeah. Like I will never know how I truly would feel about the Captain America Hydra reveal because it was revealed to me the day the book came out. Before I even knew that book was going to come out, I knew how it ended. So I will never know how I would feel about that, you know?
It takes away from having that initial gut reaction.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I guess it's the Game of Thrones syndrome, you know, is the you have to watch it before everyone ruins it for you or you just won't care, which happened to me, so I can tell you that's the truth.
Well, and that's, we actually get, you know, PDFs from a lot of the publishers, and, you know, big two... Yeah, big two Marvel and DC, we get day of. They won't let us have those early. But everyone else, Dark Horse will do them like 2 weeks early. Boom, IDW, they will give them out a week early. I think Zenoscope does 2 weeks early. So we can even read them ahead of time. But there are times when we get certain books a week ahead of time, and we already know what the spoiler is for the issue, and it hasn't even come out on the stands yet, let alone our review copies that we got a week early. You know, and it does take away
from useless because you can't talk about it.
It takes away from reviewing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rich Johnson can talk about it all he wants. He doesn't care. But, you know, for someone like us, we really can't deal with spoilers ahead of time, you know?
Yeah, I agree.
So, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so when you decided to put together the collection, the volume one of the first five issues, what kind of expense is it when you're going into, I'm assuming these are, you know, mostly being sold at conventions, so you're lugging them around with you. So how... You know, how do you decide the dynamics of how many am I going to order and, you know, variant covers and, you know, how many do I print now and how many do I, you know, keep the printer on hold and tell them, you know, hold on to the master file and I may want more later? Like, how do you, you know, agonize over that type of dealing with the mathematics?
Well, there's a ton of different factors that kind of change that. You know, for example, how many we're going to order, sometimes it'll depend on, you know, how many Kickstarter backers there are that are getting them. Sometimes it'll depend on whether or not the printer has a deal. You know, more often than not, the more you get, the cheaper it is. Right. So, you know, if they're like, well, it's only $100 more to get 5,000 copies than it would be to get, you know, 500, you just get the 5,000 and then you figure out what to do with them later, you know?
Right. And with volume one, we also sold it on Amazon, which helps a lot because you can just send a couple of boxes of them to the Amazon warehouse and they take care of it. So that kind of becomes a distribution for us.
Oh, well, cool.
And that's actually really handy because they don't charge very much and it's great. And everyone uses Amazon, so... with books especially, as opposed to loose issues, it's very expensive to print them, I'll be honest with you. So your best bet to print is usually overseas, because you have to, you know? And yeah, generally they charge less for bulk, and then you have to decide based on your Kickstarter backers, like Zach said, versus the bulk. But print on demand for a book is almost, it doesn't work very well because it's so expensive. So we usually order a large amount and then we try to sell at conventions and we try to sell on Amazon and then we use that money to make the next issue. the next issue, basically.
So when you're getting the shipments sent to you, is it just being sent to Zach, or like sort of split between the three or four of you getting shipments?
This time around, I'm having everything shipped to me, and then I'm going to be shipping Zach books basically as he goes to conventions, and I'll be shipping some to Amazon. Basically, and then I'm taking care of the rest.
Cool. How much convention touring do you do, Zach?
It depends on, I guess, if we have something to push. Like, for example, this year we were pushing the Kickstarter, so we went to a lot. We went to basically every, convention we could get our hands on before, during, and after to advertise it. For example, when we did that, we actually ran out of our stock of books. So now we're in like a month or two dead spot of not going to conventions that we could because we have no product right now and we're reordering. So I guess if we have something that we would want to push, we go to a lot, as many as we can. And if we don't, we dial it back a bit because it really is a rough go to be traveling around through the weekends, lugging, 12 books and merchandise around and stuff. And usually I do like live sketch art there, and do commissions and stuff. So on top of all that, I'm like bent over the drawing table, drawing for like 12 hours a day, every day for as long as it runs. So
it's none of the hanging out at the convention bar.
No, I've been I want to say to like a half a dozen conventions in the last 3 months plus, somewhere like a half dozen, eight, I don't remember. But either way, I did not see one thing beyond our booth at any of them. I was at the booth the entire time. I saw from the entrance to our booth and back. And that was all I saw.
So you're not hanging out in Artist Alley. You actually have a publisher booth?
We do both. It depends. If we know a convention is like, you're going to be swamped in Artist Alley, we'll just push all our stuff at the booth and say the hell with it and get one. But if we know Artist Alley will be lucrative, we'll get one.
I always feel like walking through Artist Alley, you feel like you're walking around with a bunch of people with their hand out a lot of times, like, please look at my book. Please buy something. Please. I've got trading cards. I've got sketches. I've got, colored proof pages. Please, buy something. Yeah. How hard is it to sit there for hours and hours just watching people go by? Maybe they give a glance. Maybe they don't. Do you reach out and grab someone's arm and just say, hey, look at this. Doesn't this look good?
It depends on the crowd. You gauge the crowd that you're dealing with. And, for example, when you go to Wizard World or when we were at SDCC, that is a madhouse. And people are just, steamrolling through with the blinders on, and there's just so much sensory input, they're never going to notice you unless you carnival bark at them. Right. But at like a smaller show, a lot of people will kind of take offense to the buy my book, and you kind of have to be, we tend to kind of like to do the, hi, how are you doing when somebody makes eye contact with you. And if they respond, then you're like, hey, so did you know that we, make this independent book and blah, 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 that you engage with them if they engage with you. We try not to just be like, hey, come here and buy this.
So when are we getting t-shirts?
We had t-shirts and then we ran out of them completely. We want to say we had like 100 of the things, but now they're all gone.
T-shirts didn't actually do as well as one would think they would do at conventions. So we haven't looked into getting more yet because they just weren't super interested, which is surprising.
Yeah, many of the ones that have gone were gone as prizes or rewards. For like contests we did or as part of like the Kickstarter or something like that. It is kind of hard to sell shirts at like actual venues, I guess, because people, they just, if of all the demands on their wallet at conventions, I guess t-shirts aren't the top priority.
Right. What is your, bestseller at conventions besides the books, of course?
Probably my like sketches. Cause like I said, I'm busy like all day from start to finish, doing stuff. And I always get at least, about a half a dozen of them, even at like the totally low key, nobody's there shows, I'll still get a few. And at big shows, I'm like doing them at home because I've run out of time and have to like send them to people. Like SDCC, I was in my friggin' hotel room, like staying up all night drawing them because I had so many.
That's a good problem to have.
Oh, definitely. It's not a complaint. Yeah. It's the trade and the sketches. Those are by far the biggest sellers.
Yeah, the whole convention circuit always fascinates me. Like as a lot of things for comics does, because I know a lot of the creators that go, you're there to sell your product, and other people do networking. Like I said, at the local. Ignore my printer for some reason. Printing in front of me now.
I was about to say someone's working while we're on the show.
It's my fiance, more than likely. So I'm going to mute myself. Let someone else do some talking.
I had one question. How did you guys or who came up with the name Unlikely Hero Studios? I thought that was pretty catchy.
Oh, that would be me. It was I believe it was mentioned earlier. It really was born of the idea of like, yeah, we're a bunch of nobodies that have never even been in the same room, but we have this really, really good product and we just need to get people to see it. And I think that's where it came from. Gotcha. And also the logo is based on a tattoo of Superman that I've had for years, that I drew myself back when I was in college. And I was like, man, we just need to retool that, and that's a pretty cool logo.
Cool. And you're not related to James Dolan, right? Because, you know.
No.
You wish, right? I'm referring to the current owner of Madison Square Garden and the New York Knicks and the New York Rangers, who's kind of not the most beloved sports owner in New York. Not exactly.
Luckily, I don't get that question a lot.
Really? It's unfortunate because, just very quickly while Tim is muted, Tim is one half of the four normal hosts that we normally have. There's two that are into sports and two that are not. And Dirt is one of the ones that's not. So Dirt, you know, this reference is completely beyond him.
Well, I've heard of the Knicks. I mean,
What is this sports ball you speak of?
Yes, that's exactly the joke. sports, yeah, pretty much.
All right, so going back to process for a minute, just curious, talking about you're doing all the pencils on paper, and then you're scanning them, sending right. them to Lori to be colored, and then to be inked, and then Eve to be colored. How long does the process take to go from the blank sheet of paper to a finished colored lettered page that you have ready, you know, to be sent off?
Well, that depends because we all work like full-time jobs outside of doing this. Mm-hmm. So this is still an after-hours thing for us. The pages in general are very complex. So it's probably about, 8 to, in some cases, 14 hours to do each of our stages. That's why Lori was saying she was so angry at me whenever she gets a page, because it's like I'll turn in this page that's got like 100 figures on it and all this texture detail and stuff, and she's like, it takes a really long time to do each of the pages, even under the best of circumstances. Like even if we were doing nothing but this, it would still be a very time consuming job.
So
right. Oh, sorry.
No, I was just gonna ask. You know, it's funny that you're talking about the pages that are jam-packed with detail that are the ones that that drive Laurie up the wall. You must be channeling your inner George Perez.
I have been told that I've been possessed by the spirit of George Perez.
Who's still alive, by the way?
But, Jeff Darrow and George Perez combined right. in one man is the anchor's nightmare.
exactly. I was going to ask the creative crew who your comic book influences are.
Oh, there's tons. Like obviously Jeff Darrow and George Perez in terms of way too much detail and way too many figures at once. I'm a really big fan of Art Adams. I grew up with a lot of his X-Men work and Fantastic Four stuff, and I loved it. Also, again, Psycho with the detail. And I know he's not super popular, but I've always been a big fan of Frank Miller, at least when he was young, like before he completely lost his mind.
No.
I think he's more entertaining that way.
He always did these wonderful things with like form and shadow, like where it would be almost like this is an entirely black panel and the light stuff that's hit by the light is the only thing you see. So I always love that, and I try to incorporate that a little. Like if you look at Silhouette, you'll see a lot of Frank Miller Batman in there, you know. But, I could go on for days, so you guys should probably just do yours.
Which, by the way, I love the gag of Sean Connery hiding under the cardboard box, and every time he jumps out, you see the exclamation points, the Metal Gear Solid exclamation points over everybody's head.
as I pull up the page here.
I don't know if you ever noticed, but I mean, when they show Solid Snake's dad, he's friggin' Sean Connery. Like, so when Solid Snake gets old, he's totally turning into Sean Connery. It's gonna happen. So
that's awesome.
I'm loving that judo chop.
Austin Powers there.
So the question moves to Laurie. Laurie, who are your big comic book influences?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot. Just offhand, McFarlane for inking. Wally Wood, I would say, would be
cool.
Top. I was just complaining to someone about, I just read, what was it called, Haunt, and McFarlane, I think, does the first three trades, and then someone else decides to take over the fourth trade, and I'm just like, no, it's not the same.
Right.
It's a very distinctive inking style, and I just, yeah, I love him.
I recommend the book, The Art of Todd McFarlane, the big brown, it's like a big brown trade paperback, like a soft cover, that is.
That's man, I'll have to get that.
That's pretty good.
When you're working out your bold plot here for the grand scheme of things, are you ever going to delve into where everybody seems to get all these costumes and technology? And like, do we just assume that in this reality that's just normal for everybody?
There is an origin, hands quotation marks, of the super universe, but I can't tell you what it is right now, but we will be getting into it. We will definitely explain it. There is like a moment where the world of super stops being identical to our own, and we will detail that.
Ooh, cool. I was about to say, Dirt, we skipped over Eve. Eve, let's hear who your comic book influences are.
Well, for coloring...
Penciling... Anything.
For coloring, I think Liquid.
Okay.
And Edgar Delgado and sure. Marte Gracia.
Nice.
For in general, in comics, I think John Byrne, Art Adams, McFarlane, Capullo.
Yeah, 80s and 90s. I gotcha.
Moebius. I start more like my favorite comic is X-Men, and the first X-Men things I saw was John Byrne's X-Men.
Sure.
And that's like my favorite X-Men of all time.
Do you have a big book full of hero and villain designs, or are you making some of them up as you go?
Both. We have a series Bible that has about 175 fully designed characters with backstories and personalities and all
it's
that crap that they need. but sometimes we'll just come up with an idea on the fly, and like this character literally never existed before, like, you know, he ends up on the page, but it's like, no, that's too funny. Or in some cases, we will have a character who just is a walk-on joke, and that walk-on joke is so funny, we're like, all right, we're bringing him back, you know, like they need to actually be somebody.
I love the concept of when they went down to hell and it's a big heavy metal concert going on. Was that something that you had, just a scene that you had in mind? Like, at some point in your life, you just thought, oh, you know, demons, heavy metal, of course, that makes sense.
Or was that
something that came to you while doing that script?
That scene, yeah. that entire idea was spawned from the idea of, man, wouldn't it be crazy if you get down there and he's just rocking out, you know, like...
And throwing in the Rolling Stones lyrics in the middle of a conversation.
Yeah. I was wondering how many people would actually get that joke, because it's
yeah, me too.
Oh, no.
Well, I'm not big in the Stones, and I still got it, so
yeah. Well, I'm glad people did. We have a lot of jokes that we're like, man, no one is going to get that. And then somebody does. And we're like, really? Like the Troll 2 reference in issue 3, I swore no one on earth was going to get that. And we got so many responses of people going, oh, my God.
That's cool.
So looking towards the future, are you looking for more Kickstarters with the books as they come out, or how are you planning on rolling things?
It's probably going to be a thing that has to happen at semi-regular intervals, just because it's such an expensive process to self-publish a book, and we're always going to kind of need the help of the fans, and the fans seem to be kind of into the idea of just directly getting it from us and just eschewing the whole comic store diamond thing. But you know, in the terms of right now, like we're spending, you know, we were very overfunded for the last Kickstarter, so we're using pretty much all that money to just move on forward, and that's why, you know, we're already into the next issue, and hopefully we can just get that done without, you know, needing it, and just, you know, but things will work out how they work out, I suppose.
And I didn't even realize until I was reading over, I got the, you know, the latest Kickstarter, you put out the digital volume 1 and then the issue 6, I didn't even realize that you guys did a Patreon. And does that change things? Has Patreon changed things, or is it still too new, not enough people know about it yet?
It definitely helps. It definitely helps, but it is also a very new thing that I think a lot of people aren't quite sure what it is or how it works. So both.
Yeah, I think some people are still uncomfortable kind of going into it. We have some support on Patreon, and it's helped us hugely, but people are still like, so how does it, like, I think they look at it and they're nervous about it, but we do offer it, and, sorry, go ahead.
I said because it's a commitment.
Yeah, it's kind of, well, it's kind of like a subscription, that's how I like to look at it, I guess. And, you know, we, I'm trying to remember exactly, like, at just $2 a month, like, we show people the progress of the pages, so you see the pencils and the inks, and, like, so we'll be putting up the beginning of issue 7, like, basically, in the next couple of weeks on the Patreon, and they're the only people who get to see it, and all the exclusive behind-the-scenes stuff we're using on there, and then, you know, at, I think, $5 a month, everyone gets the current issue, so you're still getting stuff with us. It's just I don't think enough people know about it or are interested in it, and we're trying to get more, but
I think also people don't understand the difference between it and a Kickstarter, where they kind of look at it as like they're the same thing, and they are in a way, but the Kickstarter is definitely more of a one lump sum for one thing, and that's it, whereas the Patreon definitely encourages more of the smaller $1 or $2 or $5 commitments over time. So it's, you know, it's just a different way to invest and basically the exact same thing.
Well, I guess also with Patreon, you have to keep producing. And that's one thing. I've backed, you know, several people on Patreon, and they're very big for 3 months, 4 months, maybe 5 months, and then it just kind of goes away. They just get bored with, you know, constantly doing the updates, or, you know, I don't know what happens, but there are very few that I've seen on the platform that are, you know, constantly putting out new material to remind people that they're still working and they're still making stuff. Whereas with Kickstarter, you're making that one project, and that one project gets done.
Yeah, that's true. It's a lot of work to actually maintain, but yeah, we post every 2 or 3 days on Patreon, actually, a new piece of artwork, a new progress on the book, new stuff like that. So we're actually really active. We've been active for, I'm not sure.
It's been at least 8 or 9 months, and
yeah,
possibly even a year by now. But the people that got on it have really stuck with us, and Lori's done a fantastic job of actually putting stuff on it that people would give a crap about. you know, like she's really good at maintaining it, you know, so that people can still have something to be interested in, which I think, like you were saying, a lot of people lose steam on that, and they you know, they just stop caring. But we're very lucky that we have these dedicated people that are, you know, both on our side of it and in the fan side of it, you know, that, like, we're sticking with it in both ends, and that's great because it really, really does help a lot.
I guess a good end note, what's something that you want to tease for fans for, I guess, what's coming up in Super?
Oh, John, that's a tough one. what is not terribly spoilery that we can tell you about? Well, I guess in the upcoming issues, you can look forward to, you know how in issue 2 when you saw the science convention, you know, it was like you realized, like, wow, there's not just Max and a couple others, there's mad scientists all over the place. Like, this is actually a very big community of mad scientists. We're going to kind of try to do that with other genres as well. Like, we're going to expand the world of Super. Like, you're going to see, you know, the superhumans of other countries, for example, and in some cases, other dimensions. You know, so, I mean, it's if you like that idea that there's this big world going on, well, in the next few issues, that world is going to get a lot bigger, and we're going to add in a lot of stuff that, you know, if you're a big fan of, you know, non-American superhero fiction, you know, be it Super Sentai or Lucha Libre style heroes or stuff like that, there's going to be a lot of it coming. We're going to expand beyond just like American comics as our basis of humor.
El Fantasmo one shot.
What was that? I'm sorry.
El Fantasmo? Do you remember that?
Oh, no, yeah. He's. You just wait. You haven't gotten the pages yet.
Oh, no.
Cool. Well, we want to thank Eve, Laurie, and Zach for joining us tonight.
Yay!
And thank you for having us. And I apologize for talking the entire time.
No worries at all. Before we let you go, we want to make sure people know where to reach you on the different social media platforms. So, Eve, if you have any websites or links or social media profiles you want to let people know about, please let them.
For Facebook, it's Epe Orozco. In DeviantArt, it's Red Eve. Twitter, I think, is Epe Orozco too. And Tumblr, Epe Orozco.
Laurie?
I have, I don't actually have a specific page for inking, but I'm LAF Model on Facebook and on Patreon as well.
All right, and Zach?
I just have a Facebook page dedicated to my art, just Zach Dolan Art on Facebook. But I mean, we have, you know, the obviously showing right there, the www.super-comic.com. We're on Facebook. We're Super Comic Official on there. And what the hell is the Twitter handle? I always forget.
The Twitter is at UH Studios, and then the Patreon is patreon.com/supercomic.
Yeah, cool. See, I told you she was a smart one.
And the website, super-comic.com, that's where you have the preview, the digital preview. People could download a PDF and get a sample of what they can get in the book.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, all of our social media links are on that page right now, and there's a preview. We're working on fleshing out the website, but for right now, it just has all of our information in the preview.
And you can also find Super on Comixology as well. Just search for Super! Exclamation mark. It should come up. Go ahead and buy
that. They are out of stock volume right now, but we're also on Amazon. You can look us up there as well. They're out of stock, but we will be refilling it shortly.
Okay, cool.
Just quick question. Being Amazon, do you, with Comixology and Amazon being connected, are you able to now sell through the Kindle ebook store, or is that a different process you have to go through?
Yeah, Volume 1 should be on the Kindle store, but there's been a questionable process. You'll have to check for me if you have a Kindle and let me know if it actually functions, because I haven't seen a lot of downloads.
Okay, cool.
So this is where I'll let Agent 70 do the nice applause.
Yay!
And as I always tell the guests, you're free to go and do what you need to do. We usually stay on after the interviews and just talk about comic news and review books from the week.
Oh, cool.
So yeah, you're welcome to stay. Of course, if I don't want to, you got things to do. But
right. And if you, I was about to say, especially if you have not yet read some of this week's comics and do not want to be spoiled, you may want to get off now.
Oh, well, I'm always behind on that stuff. So.
Yeah, I've learned.
You make them, you don't have time to read them.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I've heard once you're making them, you don't have time to read them anymore.
Right.
I said.
What are you going to do? What are you going to do?
Yeah, I probably should get back to work with the piles and piles of stuff waiting. They're always waiting on me, so.
But yeah.
Yeah, I'm finishing inking the cover of issue 7 as we speak, actually.
Nice. Oh, cool. By the way, just real quick, here's a shot of that Art of McFarlane book that I was referring to earlier. There's some cool, kind of work in progress images in here for Laurie to kind of look at. Hopefully you can find this book. I think it might still be on Amazon.
Oh, it looks nice and meaty, too.
Yeah, cool. It's called The Art of Todd McFarlane.
It's a big book.
Yeah.
Cool, thank you.
It'll fit nicely with the fly. I'm forgetting the character's name now. Flying the ant model.
Fire ant.
The fire ant. Furious fire ant. Yeah,
furious fire ant toy. The brick in the book.
Yes. That's good.
All right. Well, thanks for coming, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, and bye.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Okay.
Right. There we go. I was about to say, I guess we're going to queue up an ad read now because we are well into this show.
Hit it.
This episode of the Click Nation's Comic Book Chronicles is sponsored by Busted Tees, your home for funny, awesome, cool t-shirts that are sure to get your friends' attention. Busted Tees puts many of their popular shirt designs on sale each week. Choose from several eye-catching t-shirts inspired by pop culture, such as Bernie Larry 2016, Pretty, 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 Pretty Good, from Kirby, referencing Curb Your Enthusiasm, and Samojis, the many faces of Samuel L. Jackson as emojis. Say it one more goddamn time, and much more on sale. To help keep our podcast free, order from Busted Tees by going to cspn.us. That's CSPN.us. Then clicking on the Keep Our Podcasts free link. Click on the Busted Tees banner and then shop for awesome t-shirts. Busted Tees through CSPN.us. Do it today.
So my internet is being stupid. I have to reload the spreadsheet here. But as that's going on, we'll transition into the review portion of the show. Since we're about a little over an hour into the show, we probably might not do our full review of books, but we can at least touch on the ones that we enjoyed the most from the week.
Sure. What's funny about this week for my reading is that a number of the books that came out this week, I had been, I guess the issue beforehand, I was unable to kind of catch up on because maybe the book was too busy or I just didn't have the time. But two books this week specifically that I had to go back and make sure to read the previous issue were Captain America, Sam Wilson. I'm speaking of the issue 11 that came out this week and 10 that came out 2 or 3 weeks ago. And Totally Awesome Hulk number 8, and that forced me to go back and make sure to read number 7 because this is a two-part story that revolves around the former Incredible Hulk, Bruce Banner. The reason why I am actually specifically mentioning these two books and these two issues, in these kind of like mini two-issue arcs is because of that very fact. The stories that are being told herein basically have to you have to read the previous issue to understand what's going on in the current issue. So in Totally Awesome Hulk 7 and 8, Amadeus, the new Totally Awesome Hulk, is searching out Bruce Banner, who he claims to have cured of his gamma poisoning and his Hulk persona and curse. There's some doubt sown that this is going to be permanent because this is comics after all. But ultimately, it actually ends up in kind of a happy ending, which is weird but still kind of cool because you know as a comic book reader that it's never going to last. But it's kind of cool to see a character kind of get a happy ending in this. So, I read some of Roddy Cat's notes about issue number 8 and. Yes, I agree with him. You can hear the 1970s theme song, the Bruce Banner Walking Away, or the David Banner Walking Away music. In the last panel. So I like this. I like this little two-story arc in Totally Awesome Hulk. The same can be said for Captain America, Sam Wilson, 10 and 11. It's a nice little. I mean, it's part of a bigger arc, but this little two-issue. Mini arc involves Sam Wilson dealing with one the death of James Rhodes in the Civil War Zero issue, and that's not spoiling anything now. It's been a couple of months already, but a second storyline that involves very current socio-political issues that parallel what's going on in the real world today. So issues 10 and 11 kind of mix those two stories together, and I think it's actually getting stronger the further it goes along. There is also a Civil War II tie-in in this that does play a part in these issues, but overall I think these are pretty strong issues of the new Captain America. So that's why I wanted to kind of talk about these four books, but these two series with these two issues each in tandem.
All right, let's go back to Hulk for a minute. Sure. I actually read 7 because it was a Civil War II tie-in, at least on the cover, and so I wanted to see, how much it actually tied into it.
Right.
And I enjoyed the story in 7. I thought it was a really good look at the character.
Right.
And it was talking about how now that he doesn't have powers, he's taking all these risks. He's throwing himself out there. Like, he's trying to get into trouble now that he doesn't have powers. And you also see that even though he's not the Hulk, he still has some anger issues.
Sure.
Which, makes sense that would be amplified by the character. But as far as a Civil War II tie-in, there really wasn't anything in 7 that seemed to tie in to anything that was going on, but it looked like it might be setting up for something in the future. I haven't read 8 yet, but I have a copy sitting here.
Right.
I'm just curious, does it feel like 8 ties in more with Civil War, or does it feel like it's just
reestablishing the character so they can do something with him in the series?
A little bit of both. It's a little bit of both because of what I was saying earlier. I don't trust this happy ending. And knowing that the next issue is also a crossover with Civil War II, and I think the crossover is going to be a lot more upfront because, you know, I'm not spoiling anything. You've seen the cover solicits for the next issue, issue number 9, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you know that that is when the Totally Awesome Hulk is going to be facing off against one side of the Civil War II factions. You don't see that here in this issue, but it's part of a big setup. But you know what? It's funny. They didn't need this the banner to sell this book. You don't, like you said, it's not necessarily a Civil War II tie-in, but I guess read as a whole, it might be. We don't know. You know, it might be like a full four issues that really all weave together that Pack is or Pac has been is putting together. Like when they put out the trade,
right?
That, you know, maybe it will be like a solid four issue story that's going to tie right into Civil War II.
Well, and we've gotten, you know, Ulysses has made the prediction that Hulk is going to destroy everybody. So,
right.
Of course, when you get something like that, you don't know, is he talking about Cho or is he talking about Banner?
Right.
But it felt like if they're going to explore that at all as a question, you have to do something with Banner. You know, you got to bring him back and get him in everybody's minds. And I thought the meeting with Stark and Banner at the end of the last issue was fantastic.
Oh, that was great.
The way that they handled it. So, I'm looking forward to reading it. It's just one of those things I haven't gotten to in the last 48 hours.
What was great about, I was about to say Dirt, what was great about that is that, you know, it brings back it dug up all those memories, all the continuity that we all know, but we don't realize it was so many years ago in our time, you know, shooting him into space and World War Hulk and all that stuff, right? And I'm looking at that, I'm like, when was that? And that was just, you know, it's wild to think about how long it was, how long ago it was in our time.
I just want to throw out a side note here, just for a moment. Going back to the interview we just had with the creative team from Super, they said that they were getting ready to post some sketches on their Patreon account, patreon.com. They just posted them.
Nice.
So when they said they were getting ready to, they meant physically, like getting ready to click the button to publish those. They were published 3 minutes ago on their website, so there you go. All right, so anyway, back to comics.
Cool.
Yeah, I need to read issue 7 and 8 of Hulk. I'm behind on this Bruce Banner story. It won't matter because he'll die next week in Civil War.
Oh!
All right. I read a hilarious comic from Image Comics from the creators Nick Spencer and Steve Lieber, not sure how you pronounce it. Defense number 4, I believe the issue number was. And this issue focuses on, I believe his name is Mac. Hopefully I got his name right. But as you see on the cover there, the guy flying the airplane, though that doesn't actually come into play at all in the issue, but it's sort of a side story of him and the dog named Pretzels, who is a police dog that he has taken on as a partner. The dog doesn't really respect him, and he sort of goes around trying to get people's opinions on, you know, what he can do to get the dog on his side. And I love this. There's a character in the book who is like the crime boss, except he's like this mild-mannered, you know, wears like, you know, colored shirts and sweater vests and whatnot. But then, like, at a drop of the hat, he turns into this, like, you know...
psychopath?
Yeah, psychopath, basically. Like, there's one scene where he's saying how, you know, to get the dog to like you, they have to respect you and whatnot. And then he's like, I have two or three dogs at home, and, you know, they love me. And then the next page is like a flashback sequence of him, you know, posing for pictures with the dogs. The dog's looking all lovely. And then, like, the second to last panel is the dog's, like, ripping the guy to shreds. And then the next panel is him, like, kissing the dogs in the mouth with, like, the blood still dripping on their mouths. So it's like that kind of humor that you can find in the fits. So, yeah, I definitely recommend this book to people.
You have to wonder what kind of Google search he went through looking for images. You know, authorities might be tracking down the artist after this one.
Yeah, and Steve Lieber, he does great visual jokes of, like, doing, what's it you call it, sound effects art throughout, like, if something, an explosion happens, you know, using, like, kaboom, or if someone's jerking off, doing the sort of hand motion. like back and forth, like the movement that it leaves behind, that type of deal. So, Fitz number four.
Nice.
All right.
I know you've been a fan of the book, so.
Yeah, I look forward every time a new issue comes out every month.
I do quickly want to talk about Flintstones number one.
I'm glad you brought this up, Dirt. I didn't read it. I flipped through it at the store. I wasn't sure if I wanted to buy a physical copy. So I'm willing to, you know, I'm actually more than happy to hear your take on this.
Well, you know, DC's been going through the Hanna-Barbera library, of course, Future Quest and Wacky Land Racers and Flintstones here. They've kept the, I guess you could say, the wit of the Flintstones universe, where instead of a cell phone, he has a shell phone, which is two clamshells that fold open that he talks into. When they take selfies on a picture, you actually have a tiny little bird, you know, chipping away on a little piece of stone, the picture of them. You know, it's got that funny, you know, Flintstone, you know, visual gags that are going on. All of the stuff around the house, the vacuum cleaner and the dishwasher are all animals, and they're all, you know, secretly talking about Wilma that, you know, she doesn't hear, making fun of her artwork and all this kind of stuff. But as much as it has all that, it doesn't really have the humor. It plays it much more straight. It's much more of a drama, I guess you could say. Even though there's this crazy stuff going on, the characters themselves are never really doing anything crazy. There's not a lot of jokes. There's no one-liners. There's none of the, like, Honeymooners or I Love Lucy style gags of something getting out of hand and they've got to take care of the situation. It's I don't necessarily want to say it's darker, but it's not fun. And that to me kind of killed the hopes I had in this book. Like I understand that a lot of the stuff they're doing in this new expanded Hanna-Barbera is taking things more seriously. But when he's, you know, talking, when he's talking to his wife about her artwork, and her artwork is handprints on the wall because, you know, cave people do handprints, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But they're having this deep philosophical conversation about how they would go out as hunter-gatherers, and, you know, part of the tribe would get killed while they were doing the hunt, and so, you know, having the handprints on the wall was the way to remember that these people existed, and it's the only memory they have of the loved ones that they've lost. And it's, you know, it's kind of deep, but at the same time, it's, you know, handprints on a canvas and basic cave paintings. So it's like, on the one hand, the wit is still there, but the humor isn't there. And to me, it just, I don't know, it was just kind of awkward the whole time because it wasn't really enjoyable like you would expect. It comes across much more as this drama, as these character pieces for, you know, who these people really are, but at the same time, they're still in the car with the stone wheels and kicking their feet on the road as they're, you know, driving along. So, I don't know, it just didn't work for me.
I didn't sense any sort of happiness or joy in the story.
No.
That's one thing that I found lacking, even just flipping through it. You know, nothing was jumping off at me on the from the page saying, hi, you know, like, hey, we're telling a fun story here. So, you know, I put it back down. I still have our review copies, but, you know, I don't know.
This whole Hanna-Barbera, what do you call it? Not off-brand, but...
relaunch?
Imprint, thank you. Yes. Imprint. Yeah, besides, like, Future Quest, which issue two came out, I haven't read it yet because it's kind of been a busy week. That's like the only one I was like really enthusiastic about going into it. Scooby Apocalypse a little bit, but like the Flintstones, I'll check it out this weekend. But of course, after your review, it's not looking too good for it. And I heard I flipped through a couple of first pages of Wacky Raceland. For one, I wasn't familiar with the property to begin with, so I knew nothing about it, and it just looked odd to me. Not sure if it's something I'd want to read on a monthly basis. So it's just,
yeah, and there's also this weird, there's also this whole weird subplot about Fred and Barney being war veterans from a war between the Homo sapiens and the Neanderthals, and they have these like traumatic flashbacks. And the headpiece he's wearing here, instead of this being from the lodge, you know, the Grand Poobah and all of that, those are the helmets that I guess they wore into battle.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there's like this really kind of dark undertone
to some of the scenes when he's going to like his post-traumatic stress group veterans. And you would think that these would be, if handled correctly, there are opportunities you can put humor in there for the sake of people versus dinosaurs or people, you know, versus cavemen while riding on dinosaurs or, you know, all that kind of stuff. But none of it's there. And so you get done reading the book and you don't feel happy. You know, you actually feel kind of bad about the whole thing. So I read the first one, I gave it a shot, but I'm not coming back for it.
Hmm.
Okay. Something that I will be coming back for more of is Green Arrow number 2, the nice. Sort of surprise hit of the DC Rebirth continues here, where I won't go into too many spoilers, but things don't look good for Oliver Queen at the end of issue 1, and then we pick up on it on issue 2. Of course, it still co-stars Black Canary, who shows up sort of near the end to do some research to find out what's happened to Ollie. We get the reappearance of a character from the hit Arrow TV show. I won't say who, but they show up.
I'm about to say
Arrow
spoiler bell.
No, okay. they show up as well, and it proved to be very entertaining for me. The couple of panels this person appeared in. Of course, now it's escaping my mind the name of the Nine Circles is like this, appears at least for now to be this mysterious group working in the shadows that's causing all this grief for Oliver. So, but I want to touch on the art from Otto Schmidt. He does the colors and the art, especially his color work really sort of sets the tone for this like sort of dark, sort of drama filled story that's taking place right now in the book. So props to him for that. And then also, I love his penciling work where everyone looks so young and fresh. And I don't know, he has a way of crafting the panels and the action that, especially the action, you know, really has this energetic feel to it. But even the quieter moments of someone standing talking to another character or someone posing on the top of a rooftop looking over the city, it's filled with a lot of energy as well. So the Benjamin Percy, the writer, and Otto Schmidt, at least the artist on, I'm assuming, this first opening arc, seem to be working well together. And the book is doing pretty well sales-wise, I hear, as well. So.
Yeah, actually it is. It's surprising because of how poorly Green Arrow sold before. But I guess if you take a guy who's responsible for the TV show and put him on the comic, that definitely helps.
Yeah.
So.
And yeah, and the same writer who was writing it pre-DC Rebirth is the writer here. So maybe it was just adding Black Canary and starting with the new number one got everyone excited.
A book I enjoyed a lot this week that I really didn't expect to was Kingpin, the Civil War II tie-in book.
Sure.
I don't know if either of you guys read this, but we actually had a review copy sent to us several weeks ago. I was actually really surprised. I thought for sure this was going to be one of those quick cash-in, you know, probably has nothing to do with Civil War, and they just wanted to have Kingpin there because it's a character that they can, you know, maybe throw in a Daredevil appearance and sell it to those people. But they actually crafted a story that I thought was really well told with him finding a new Inhuman. And it looks like this Inhuman is going to, without giving too much away, is going to give him the ability to get away with a lot of things that the rest, the Marvel Universe heroes are not going to be able to find out about. And I love the way it treated the heroes of the Marvel Universe. When they come knocking on Kingpin's door, they really come across as like the bullies from an 80s movie, like getting in his face and poking their fingers at him and like, we're going to catch you one of these days. And he's like, I haven't done anything. Like I haven't done a single thing that you're trying to pin on me here. And technically he really hasn't. But I found it very humorous, and I really enjoyed a lot of the stuff that was going on in this book.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to reading it.
It was not on my list of things to get to over the weekend, but I'm going to add it because I like what you had to say.
That's yeah, cool. And you will. I mean, there were a couple times that I did, you know, snicker out loud at the way they were doing the story. I thought it was really well done. Yeah. So I definitely recommend it for everybody.
Nice. All right. Let's see. I don't know if there's too many more books that you guys. Oh, maybe Batman number 2?
Yeah.
What'd you think of that? It was a pretty interesting continuation of the basically the second appearance of two new heroes in Gotham.
Yeah, it's funny because the story that's happening in Batman in many ways mirrors what's happening in Detective.
Right.
But the thing is, I really like the story that's happening here better.
Okay.
And maybe that's because Tom King is helping to write it.
Sure.
He has these two new heroes that have superpowers that are very much like Superman in many ways.
Right.
But we still don't know where they came from, the extent of their powers, what they're really doing here. But Batman right. has agreed
they basically to give a lot of stock answers when they're pressed for answers and, you know, with questions. They basically say, we're here to help, we're here to do good. You know, there's not much else that they are giving up at this point. Obviously, that's for later on in the series.
And you kind of get the sense from Batman that, of course, he's Batman. He doesn't really trust him. But then on the other hand, he knows that he is getting older and he's not, you know, quite the fighter he used to be. So maybe he does need someone to pick up some slack, which is, again, mirroring a lot of the stuff that's happening in Detective and the story that's going on in there. But I don't know why. For some reason, I just like the story a whole lot more. I think because Detective spends so much time dealing with, Robin and Spoiler are having, like, this hidden relationship and Orphan knows about it, but, you know, she's good at keeping a secret and blah, 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 that, you know, CW style stuff that we've discussed before, whereas this book doesn't have that. This is more of just a straight superhero. People with powers appear, and they're not ready to give up all their secrets, and for someone like Batman, that makes sense. Like, maybe he trusts them more because they're not as open about everything, and they have right. hidden identities, so maybe, you know, he's like, I know where you're coming from. But again, the artwork is beautiful from David Finch in this book, it plays out, like the first one was all about this plane crash that he's trying to stop mm-hmm. and the mechanics of going through this. This also has a giant battle at the beginning, and it has that summer blockbuster, epic feel, like when we talked about Justice League and the last arc that they had
right.
With the Darkseid War. I mean, this has got big stuff going on, the big fights, it gets into the battles, and you see, you know, giant stuff crumbling and falling and all of that gritty action stuff going on. So I've just really enjoyed reading these last couple issues of Batman. I'm looking forward a lot more to what's going to happen in this series than what seems to be playing out in Detective.
All right. A couple of things. One, I find that it was actually distracting to see that they are staying consistent with the purple lining on the inside of Batman's cape. I was distracted by that. Two, Finch's artwork in this is good, but it made me kind of, you know, the Jim Gordon, his rendition of James Gordon is so retro.
It really is.
Right, and I'm thinking to myself, and I'm like, wait a second, wasn't this dude just like a bald crew cut, kind of harkening back to his days in the Marines? Now we've got like old disheveled Jim Gordon smoking a pipe.
Yeah. But this is Rebirth. This is about centering the characters back to where they're more of the classic, iconic versions of the characters, and that is Jim Gordon.
Right. Like I said, it's just it's so retro. I understand we're in the midst of this Rebirth thing, but still, you know, we saw this Jim Gordon running around in a bat suit, or, you know, bat mech suit for so long that seeing him like this again is a little. It's a little jarring, to say the least.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. Oh, and by the way, what did you think of the cliffhanger ending?
It was teased in the first issues, apparently. I read too many news articles. Where
I was like, Kim, what are you talking about? I don't remember any of this stuff.
Where he supposedly, the hooded figure in issue one said a phrase that they also said in their very first appearance way back in whatever 1970s Batman comic. Gosh. So if you recognize that, then you knew who the character was.
Gotcha. That's funny. All right.
But yeah.
All right. What else do we got here? Did anyone read Amazing Spider-Man number 15? Anybody?
Ooh.
All right. We might be in rapid fire right now.
Well, okay, wait. If we're going to do rapid fire...
Yeah, I was about to say, or... No, because I'm just checking to see... Oh, because Dirt didn't put in anything on his list.
I never do. You should know that by now.
Just to see if there's anything else in common, because I see some stuff on Roddy's list, but he's not here to talk about it, so...
Well, did anybody read Moon Knight?
I did. I actually didn't put it on my list.
Ah, well, see? Okay,
then. I forgot to type. I didn't have a chance to type it in.
I like how, you know, when it started, you didn't know, was he paranoid, was he going crazy, or is there something actually mystical going on? And given the nature of his powers,
it would make sense that there would be something missed. I mean, this is a guy who talks to an ancient Egyptian god, you know, on a daily basis. So it makes sense that there's a little bit of crazy, even, you know, if he's telling the truth. And so I like how the story has now morphed into this place where what he has been seeing that everybody around him said was crazy is actually reality, but that reality is crazy. So in the sense that he was 100% correct this entire time, the fact that he was correct is in and of itself a crazy thing to have happen. And it fully embraces the absurdity of that idea. So we've lost some of the members of this escape team in different ways. One of the characters in this issue basically finds the place where they work, and it's a place that they've worked a lot and poured a lot of their self into, and this character just basically says, this is where I belong, I'm just going to stay here, you guys go on your journey, this is where my journey needs to end.
Right.
And that's one of those, you know, the character's not sacrificing themselves, but I like the idea that it plays on that not all of these characters are tied to his story completely. Like, there could be other things going on with this character in the future at the same time that this book doesn't need to tell, because this book is focused on Mark Spector, not these other characters. And that's something that you don't always see, because you always think of these side characters, their stories always depend on the main character, whereas, you know, you have a character here who's breaking out and saying, I've got my own thing to do here, my own story, and go off on their own way. And I just thought that was a brilliant piece of storytelling that Jeff Lemire threw in here.
I need to catch up on issue 3.
Yeah, it's been a really good series. I've been surprised.
Yeah, I was about to say, this issue is well written. I liked where this issue took the story. Like Dirt said, you know, we have a little bit of an evolution in the supporting characters. In the book, we lose, spoiler alert, we lose a long time supporting character, in a bad way. And this other character that Dirt is referencing, we lose, not through any sort of sacrifice or heroic sacrifice or anything like that, but they just sort of found their way to the end of their part of the story. So that, you know, that was pretty cool. But we still have Mark Spector and Marlene,
his girlfriend.
I forget her name. I've known it on and off, but they're basically because at the end of the day, they're the ones who make it to the end of the book.
Okay. Yeah, definitely snuck up on me, because I've never cared about Moon Knight at all ever. And the first issue surprised me, and the second was good as well. I feel like issue 3 came out like 2 weeks ago, and I'm still like back that far as some of the older books I need to read. So then this one came out this week, and I was like, whoa, wait, I haven't read the last one yet.
I'm just wondering how far the story can go. Like, I can see it wrapping up in 2 issues, because, you know, 6 issues, that's your trade right there. I'm just wondering if there's anything in the story that continues on beyond that, or if issue 7 is just going to be, you know, him back in the city doing his thing as a crime fighter, and, you know, all the rest of it goes away, or if we're looking at this giant ongoing, this guy's crazy and delving into these other realities and whatever, if that's going to be an ongoing theme. But I'm interested to see how it plays out.
I can see it just ending like at 6 issues or something like that.
Right. I don't know what the sales numbers are on this are, though. So they can't be. They're probably not that high. Moon Knight's never been much of a sales champion.
Cool.
Yeah, unless you get a hot writer or hot artist on it. Just
right. Like, what was it? Ellis and Shalvey?
Right.
Yeah.
And then I remember in the 90s it only took off because, was it Philip Tan, I think, became the artist on it? And he was...
No, it was Stephen Platt. Platt.
That's who it was.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
Yeah, and so then suddenly everybody wanted to buy it, and that's when I was like, "Oh, this guy looks like Image artwork. I'm not buying it anymore."
I remember that. Oh, whatever happened to that guy, Platt? That's a Google search.
He's working at In-N-Out Burger. I don't know.
Oh no!
Remember, all hate mail.
No, that's right. All hate mail.
At Tim right, Tim 98 on Twitter.
Hey, man.
All right. Rapid fire?
Yeah,
go ahead.
All right, so just very quickly, Amazing Spider-Man number 15 is a surprising pseudo-end to this story that introduced Regent into the Marvel Universe out of the Secret Wars miniseries. When I say surprising, you know, like the story sort of ends in a kind of a typical superhero fashion, but then, you know, there's an epilogue that leads us not quite into Dead No More, because I believe there's one issue before Dead No More starts, but it was kind of an unsatisfying end to the story. It felt very anticlimactic.
Did it feel rushed?
No, not rushed. Not rushed, because think of how many issues they've been fighting Regent for. You know, they've been fighting Regent for the better part of 3 issues now.
Okay. Yeah, it has been multiple issues now. So.
Right. So, you know, that definitely doesn't feel like a rushed ending, but it felt anticlimactic because, you know, we get to this point where, yeah, this is how they take him down. And, you know, you're starting to think, well, what about that alternate future? You know, like, what is this? They kind of hint at it, that they kind of hint that the characters kind of recognize that they've interacted in a certain way together and before, maybe in as a reference to the Renew Your Vows limited series. You know, so when you read it, you'll see what I'm speaking of. I wanted to just touch very quickly the other Spider book that's out this week, Spider-Woman number 9. It's a Civil War II crossover. This is a very strong book. This is a lot of very strong character work because it involves a character who wants to stay neutral or on the sidelines of this battle between Captain Marvel's side and Iron Man's side. And, you know, it's a story of how, you know, Spider-Woman is trying to stay out of it when her best friend is leading one of the sides, one of the factions. So, you know, it's a lot of great character work in this book. You know, Hopeless is writing, you know, is continually writing a great book. I don't know if you guys are reading this, but I definitely recommend it. I know I've spoken very highly of it for a number of months now. So, you know, this is something you could still get into. It's only issue number 9. And finally, Invincible Iron Man number 11. This was another anticlimactic type of issue. It's still weird to see some characters who, I won't spoil everything about this book, but there's still some characters running around in this book who are now dead.
Yes.
it's still kind of weird to read a story like this. So.
And it did, it felt to me like the ending kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Where, you know, where's Tony Stark? We can't find Tony Stark. Where's Tony Stark? And then suddenly it's like, oh, well, that's him. And by the way, we fought the bad guy and everything's over and time to move on.
Right.
Like it definitely, like it was trying to go somewhere at one point in time, and they're like, oh, yeah, right, Civil War II, wrap it up.
Mm-hmm. But it's also a setup for something that we're going to talk about in the news.
Yep.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, the story could have been paced better.
I agree with that. That I definitely agree with, but that's Bendis for you.
Yeah.
All righty. Tim, Dirt, what else you got for rapid fire?
See, I've got Empress number 4. When we left the Queen Emporia and her family.
Escapees?
Escapees is what I was looking for. Thank you. They were trapped on a polluted planet. The air is so thick and polluted that their transporter ship can't get a reading to see where he needs to teleport them to next. They get ambushed by some not scavengers, but of course now my words are escaping me. Outlaws, I guess you can call them. They kidnap the kids, and Queen Emporia, Tor, and Dante go on this sort of adventure where they take out the people who were holding them hostage, and then now they have to go rescue the kids. So that's kind of where the issue ends. Great art from Stuart Immonen again, and with Wade von Grabadger on colors. And I've Sfortina, who does the lettering.
Sfortina, yeah,
I believe does the lettering for it. But
I it's coloring, but I could be wrong.
It's either colors or Wade the inker. Maybe I'm getting my credits people confused. I apologize. But either way, what's interesting is since I think maybe issue 1 is the last time I can remember the king having like a significant presence in the book. It's mostly just been the family being hunted and them, you know, running around the galaxy, and we haven't seen anything because, like in the first issue, we got a nice like flashback to when they first met, and she was all infatuated with the king. But since then, there haven't been any more flashbacks, hardly any references to the king. So I wonder, with the kids being kidnapped, are they going to be taken back to their father now? And then, oh, we also get some Adam, who's like the teen son of Emporia gets a little limelight in the beginning of the issue because he seems to be have the brains of the children, so he gets to try to build a ship to get them off that polluted planet.
Any other quick ones?
No, I think we can just do clicks of the week now.
Well, actually, I've got a couple.
Go for it.
I want to talk about Superman briefly. You know, Action Comics has been the book that's full of action. They've made that very clear with the big battles and everything. So it makes sense that Superman is trying to do something different. And so whereas Action is all about the action and the fighting and the, you know, big threats and whatever, Superman really is more about the man. It's more about him and his wife and his son and trying to be a family and trying to raise this child who's also going to have superpowers and being a parent. And they're still fighting, you know, they're still, you know, Superman being Superman, but there's also a lot more about, you know, what it is to be him in this world and to, you know, try to have a family. So I appreciate that the books are doing two different things instead of just being, you know, the same story, just, you know, two different threads of it in the different books or, you know, whatever. They're differentiating themselves very well. And I really enjoy seeing this aspect of what it means to be the character, to be that guy. So I think it's actually, if you love the Superman book, this is a really good, you know, title to be following right now to see what it's like to be Superman just dealing with life in general. Justice League was okay. Unlike what we were talking about with Darkseid War and how that was like this big, epic, bold story, this is a very safe special. This is the Rebirth special, so it's not actually the ongoing series yet. But this is a setup for new readers. So if you have not been reading Justice League and you want to get an idea of what the team dynamic is and you know, who all the characters are, this is the book that basically, you know, has the conversations between the people, so you see where they all stand and how they all work together. They fight, you know, a threat and they beat it, and it's a one and done special, but it really just exists only to bring in readers who maybe aren't familiar with the team and to give them an idea of what the Justice League is like nowadays. So in that respect, it's okay as a one shot, but, you know, really nothing too bold or exciting happening in that book. And then Spidey, the ongoing story of Peter Parker as a teenager, this is still a lot of fun. This is still a book that, you know, even though it's geared more towards younger readers, you know, my son reads it, loves it. It's a book I can still read and enjoy because it's classic superhero storytelling. Again, if you're a fan of, like, Web Warriors and that type of stuff, this fits in that same type of feel where it's just that classic superhero stuff going on. And especially with him going through the Gwen Stacy stuff right now, just really like how he, you know, is dealing with all of that teenager. There's no angst, you know, with him because he is pretty much an upbeat, you know, character in general. But just fun to see how he's dealing with, you know, well, it's a date. No, it's not a date. Well, it is a date. Well, we're together. We're out. We're seeing a movie. No, we're just friends. Like the way he's dealing with all that stuff as Peter Parker is always kind of the fun stuff that I've always enjoyed with the Spider-Man character. So in the middle of all that, a lot of fun, good times. So those are my quick, just some quick hits going through some of those books.
Cool.
Clicks of the week.
Well, mine's actually pretty easy because there was
no book that you didn't talk about?
Yes. because there's no
Something
vision.
Something I retweeted this week?
Yes. Okay. Which actually Mitch Drudge retweeted too. So.
Nice.
But because there's no Vision this week, I don't have to fight the Tom King books, and I can just go with Sheriff of Babylon straight up again. You know, last issue I kind of was a little harder on because of the way it focused away from our main character and followed the side characters. But now in this book, things exploded two issues ago and just went crazy. Last issue dealt with the side characters dealing with that. Now we get back to our main character and the way he's trying to fix the problems and bring everybody back together. And one of the ways in which he's going to do it is he finds out that these characters are connected to someone who may be one of the head terrorists in Iraq fighting against the United States, and both of the characters that he's dealing with are people who are willing to help out in bringing this guy down. You know, the same as us. They want security, they want stability, they want safety, they want to be able to people to raise their kids and, you know, live in peace. And so they're willing to, use family connections, use business connections, use whatever to try to... We know that it's not going to work as readers. We know that they're not going to put an end to the violence in Iraq. You know, I mean, we live in the real world. We know that. But these characters are going to try to make it happen. And so this issue is starting to really all the little snippets of things that you've seen where they know the wrong person, they've been hanging out with the wrong person, they've been... you thought maybe they were doing some shady underhanded deals with some people... It's all been part of this network of trying to bring this guy to justice, I guess, is the best way to say it. So we're starting to see this grand plan come together to bring stability and security. And so I just love seeing these characters, small things that we've seen with these characters throughout the book that made you kind of question their loyalty and kind of cause some of the problems that we've seen happen have been part building up to what's going to be a big finale here in the series. So I really appreciate when you see a framework with characters and stories that build, and you can tell that some of these things that you thought were just there to fill pages because they have to put out a monthly book have actually been there because they need to be there in order to pay off as the story goes on. And that's what we're seeing here with Sheriff of Babylon. It's one of those books where now I need to go back and reread some of those early things because I kind of remember something about what happened earlier, or I kind of remember a piece of a conversation that I know plays into this. Now I need to go back and see what details I missed as all this stuff comes together. So once again, my click of the week is going to be Sheriff of Babylon. And again, I cannot recommend it highly enough. Everybody should be reading this one. Yeah,
absolutely. Still working on catching up.
Well, get to it, man.
Yeah, man. All right. My click of the week, surprisingly enough, I'd love to do it for two books because I basically read them together. But keeping with the theme of just having to pick one book for the week, I'm going to go with Totally Awesome Hulk number 8. But I definitely insist that anyone who picks up this book, because I'm recommending it, go back and find issue number 7 because you absolutely need to read those two issues together.
And I am going to go with... I'm going to go with Defense number 4.
Nice.
Yeah.
Oh, what was Roddy's?
Oh, yeah. Let me skip to the bottom here. Scroll. Sure, it was probably like Cap.
It was Captain America Sam Wilson number 11.
Ah, I was right.
All right. There we go.
Cool.
Now you have to leave us.
Yeah, I got to get going. It's late. It's getting late for me. Got a bunch of stuff going on. So anyway, actually, I really enjoyed having the guys from Super on. So if you guys happen to see him on Twitter or, you know, Facebook or anything like that, let them know that it was definitely appreciated by all of us. And I hope you guys, I'll see you next week.
You got it. Take care. Alrighty.
I will say Laurie liked our Facebook page.
Nice. Hold on, let me get a script up. We could do a quick ad read, or you want to wait until after the news?
Go ahead and have it up, and I'm going to blow through this news.
Alright.
We are running late.
Go for it.
Let's see. So cinematic news is Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. casting Ghost Rider. Maybe.
Bum.
The Flash adds Harry Potter star Tom Felton as series regular.
That was weird news.
He'll be playing Julian Dorn, who TV Line describes as a fellow CSI at the Central City Police Department, who suspects there's more to Barry Allen than just his good guy reputation.
Alrighty.
I only know who's Tom Felton.
Tom Felton is Draco Malfoy.
Oh, that guy.
Yeah. That's why it was so weird to see the news that Felton had been cast in something, you know, like something else that's genre that, you know, like you're trying to think, all right, who would they cast him as? Who would he fit as? And he's some, you know,
the
new character.
Kid, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
I've been forced to watch Harry Potter, so.
Oh, don't say forced. I know it's you and Magic.
Yep. All Spider-Man right. Homecoming adds Tiffany Espenson and Garcelle Beauvais.
Garcelle Beauvais is awesome.
Yes, everyone's already speculating that she's Miles Morales' mother.
Mm-mm-mm.
I'm hoping that Miles isn't a regular character in the universe and he gets like introduced after Doctor Strange introduces like parallel universes.
I don't know.
I want that to be a thing.
I don't know. I honestly could not tell you where they're going with this because it's all out of whack. You know, like in terms, you know, what's funny is that, you know, given what the comic side is doing with their characters, there's no way of knowing what they're going to do with the movie characters and how they're going to weave all this stuff together because they've been weaving this stuff together with, especially with Captain America, you know, like some of the Ultimate stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's hard to tell now.
Yeah. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. season 4 adds female robot Latino brothers. What?
Okay, they're going to bring in the LMDs, life model decoys, and...
Roddy Cat has a note saying he's holding out for Al being Jocasta.
Al.
Or AI.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Jocasta. Jocasta was... the bride that that Ultron made for himself in the comics. So yeah. You know,
okay, they've introduced life model decoys on the show.
Right. Okay.
Supergirl confirms an adventurous new season 2 premiere title.
Okay.
It'll be at San Diego Comic-Con, which is coming up in 2 weeks. Noel Neal, Lois Lane on Adventures of Superman, has passed away at the age of 95.
Rest in peace.
Arrow Season 5 put Stardust back in the ring with Stephen Amell.
Gotcha. So didn't Stardust get kicked out of the WWE?
Well, he left on his own accord.
Oh, okay.
He wants to go... He was tired of playing Stardust and wants to be back playing himself. So
okay.
He's on the indie circuit, but he'll be appearing on Arrow, apparently.
Okay.
So good for Cody Rhodes. Oh, and CW Seed is now streaming the Constantine TV series for free.
Nice.
That's nice of them. Star Wars Rebels producer hints at future movie tie-ins. And a Kindred wants to play Squirrel Girl.
That's actually a really good fan casting. I mean, it's not a fan casting because it's something that she brought up. She said her brother fan casted her, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But when I saw, you know, I saw like some fan made picture, I thought to myself, that's actually really appropriate.
Yeah, that works.
Yeah.
Justice League cast Julian Lewis-Jones in the mystery role.
All right.
There's a new Batman Unlimited animated movie coming out, Mech versus Mutants, and a new trailer came out. Okay. I watched that today. Kevin Smith reveals how he'd bring Onomatopoeia to Arrow.
Okay.
Supergirl hitting CW in August ahead of season 2 premiere. Okay.
All right.
Netflix and CW have confirmed a full season streaming deal where full seasons will appear on Netflix 8 days after the finale. I'm kind of bummed about that because I'm used to Hulu having episodes the next day, and now that won't happen now.
You just got to wait for Netflix to pick it up.
I was going to go all digital, no cable this season, but maybe hopefully I can get like CW over an over-the-air antenna.
Right.
Hopefully. Cross my fingers.
Sure, sure.
Let's see. I don't have Twitter up, but we had some... We're given some rumors about the new DC TV show Powerless. That's
going to air on NBC. We can't discuss, but we're lucky enough to get some info.
Yeah. George Takei says making Sulu gay doesn't honor Roddenberry's Star Trek vision.
Yeah, we just skipped over the main story, which is Hikaru Sulu will be the first openly gay character in the Star Trek film franchise. So they're making John Cho's version of the character openly gay. And apparently, I didn't read this, but I guess apparently George Takei isn't a fan of this particular move.
Yeah, I saw that earlier. Like, okay. Prelude to Transformers Combiner Wars. Victorian. This is going to be a motion comic.
Okay.
Tomb Raider reboot receives 2018 release date. Spider-Man Homecoming adds Nice Guys Breakout and Drury Rice.
Right. This is the speculation that she's going to be playing Gwen Stacy.
Okay.
Because she's, blonde. But you never know with this. There's no way to know.
Never know.
Yeah. All right. So we'll get to the comic news. Let's see if we can't split this up too. Midnighter and Apollo return a new miniseries from Orlando and Blanco this fall and getting them back together as a couple.
Marvel gets patriotic with U.S. Avengers series from Al Ewan and Paco Medina.
I have to say, I kind of sighed when I saw the title and I saw the cover.
Oh, you sighed.
Yeah, I was just kind of like, I groaned. Yeah, I groaned. But I'm hoping that it's not going to be as bad as it almost sounds to me, you know?
I'm a Al Ewan fan, and so I'll be enjoying this. It's a transition, a seamless transition from what he's doing in that new Avengers series. So,
right.
There was a bunch of Marvel, teen heroes saying they quit Images. Which we found out is
a lead up to the Marvel Teen Heroes uniting in a new Champions book, written by Mark Waid and drawn by Umberto Ramos,
who I forgot were the Impulse creative team back at DC.
Right,
I made a joke when I posted the press release for it that inside the press release they named all the heroes on the team but neglected to mention Cyclops, young Cyclops.
Right,
even though he's like on the cover. Image.
Sure. Well, it's everyone against the X-Men nowadays, right?
Yep. And so, we'll get to them a little news article here or there.
Page, right. Yeah. So apparently the Great Lakes Avengers are coming back too.
That's the one I sighed at.
Or groaned at, yeah.
Do not. I felt bad because I tweeted, I was like, yep, I won't be paying any attention to Great Lakes Avengers or something like that. And then the artist on the book liked it.
Oh, no.
Though I will say, the art, I do like the preview art that they had looks nice. So.
Sure.
But yeah, I have no history with Great Lakes Avengers. These are characters I know nothing about. Don't really have an interest to keep up with their stories. But, I mean, it fits in with the same type of Squirrel Girl, Howard the Duck, Deadpool type humor that normally I like humor in my comics, but for some reason, like, those books I haven't really gotten into as much.
Mm-hmm.
From Marvel, put it that way.
Sure, sure. I'll take this next one.
Yes.
This one's right up my alley. So Brooklyn will immortalize hometown hero Captain America with a 13-foot-tall bronze statue. So us Brooklyn residents are in for a treat as the borough will proudly display a 13-foot-tall bronze statue of Captain America. As per USA Today, the statue will first be unveiled at San Diego Comic-Con later this month before becoming a permanent resident of Prospect Park on August 10th. Comic Cave Studios designed the monument, which will feature the "I'm just a kid from Brooklyn" quote from Captain America: The First Avenger. So I was jazzed. This brought a big smile to my face in a week where the news has been very tough to tolerate and to handle and to get our minds wrapped around. This little bit of news was a great, it brought a nice smile to my face. It was a nice little bit of good news.
Riri Williams replaces Tony Stark in Invincible Iron Man number one for Marvel Now.
So this was announced in Time magazine. So, you know, following along in the footsteps of all the other announcements from Marvel that go in mainstream media.
Yeah. So I'd be more, I'm curious to see how it plays out. But with Riri being such a new character, I don't have that attachment to her yet.
Sure.
Hopefully that comes. I'm glad that Stefano Caselli is going to be the artist on it.
Listen, they want to keep on all the big launches, they want to keep a name artist. And Caselli may not be a name artist, but to those of us in the know, he's a name artist. You know, he's quality. He puts out quality work. So they want to keep someone who puts out, you know, consistent quality work on these titles where they're relaunching with new characters.
Yep.
So this Doctor Strange prequel comic that came out this week that I did not pick up, but I guess I'm going to have to look at, it hints at movie secrets. So I guess that gives us a reason to take a look at it.
Yep.
So I was going to skip that one. Or?
Yeah, I'll skip it. Don't care about Disney Infinity figures.
Talk about the next one.
Cyclops' Fate, Mutant and Humans War revealed in Marvel's Death of X.
Right, so this is a new series announced via Entertainment Weekly, of course. It's a 4-issue series that basically tells us what happened during the 8-month gap after Secret Wars between these two groups.
Yeah, so I was ranting actually yesterday about how with, you know, all the hype is now building up for Marvel Now in the fall. And I'm like, I feel like all new, all different Marvel hasn't really gotten off the ground because Civil War is coming in and like hijacking what's taking place in the stories. And some of these books haven't even got to like 20 issues that have launched in Marvel Now, like Invincible Iron Man. What issue 11 came out this week?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then it's already going to relaunch.
With a new character.
In 3 months. So it gets like issue 14, maybe 15. And then it's going to relaunch again. It's like, and I'm becoming an old crotchety comics fan.
Welcome to the club. Hold on.
Before, I used to not care about the, you know, the numbering and whatnot, but I want some kind of consistency here.
Sure.
Is there really a need to relaunch Invincible with the new number one? It'll help the sales for Riri, so that's good, of course, but that's all I can do. I can just sigh.
Yeah, exactly. Sigh, groan. Tell me about it. So anyway, this was a very exciting show tonight. We had a lot of stuff going on. We want to thank the creative team of Super! Exclamation point for coming on to talk about their book. These are folks from Unlikely Heroes Studio LLC. You can go to www.super-comic.com to find their webpage that has a free comic preview of their volume 1, issues 1 through 5, and links to getting the books on Scribd, Goodreads, Comixology, and trying to contact the people over Amazon. Didn't they say they were out of stock or something like that?
Yeah.
So, but you can put in an order for when.
Or they were out of stock on Comixology, I think.
And oh, is that what it is?
Okay. Yeah, I think. Hopefully I got that right.
Right. And you can also support them, support Super on Patreon. So you can find a link on that page.
Cool. Last ad read?
Sure. I will get that in. Visit, keep our podcast free by shopping at Amazon. This is the shortest one we have. Visit CSPN.us, then click the Keep Our Podcast Free link at the top of the page. From there, scroll down and click on the Amazon link to shop. Purchase items from Amazon as you normally would, whether it's books, music, or electronics, and so on and so forth. For every purchase made on Amazon through our link, Amazon sends the CSPN a payment that helps us keep the Click Nation's Comic Book Chronicles podcast free for our listeners at no extra cost to you. Amazon.com through CSPN.us. Do it today. Cool.
Follow us on our Twitter accounts, at TimDogg98 and at CBCron, and go to the website, TheClickNation.com. Agent 70 is at Agent_70 and on Twitter and Instagram.
Yep.
Dirt is at PCN_Dirt and at PopCultureNetwork.com. Roddy Cat, who couldn't be with us tonight, is at Roddy Cat and at News Nerds Need. And with that, we'll be back next week with a Nerd Sign episode of Comic Book Chronicles.
As we move closer and closer to San Diego Comic Con.
And we are the Comic Book Chronicles, and we are signing off.
Hey!